Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. For the next hour, we will divert from our normal presentation of the past week in review. You'll hear the full-length versions of many of the interviews and features that we have presented through the past few months on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. In the wake of the expanding trade war between the United States and China, China started to make threats to the United States, not military threats, but threats to the U.S. economy. I spoke with Jeff Moon, a China government affairs and trade consultant and a former U.S. trade representative to China under the Barack Obama administration. I asked him about a report that appeared in the People's Daily, a newspaper of the Chinese Communist Party, that contained the phrase, "Don't tell us we didn't warn you," in its story about possible Chinese retaliation for increased tariffs placed on Chinese goods by the United States.
Well, I think this is being communicated by the Chinese government to express the seriousness of the situation. They've only used that phrase a couple times prior to previous wars, and the fact that they want foreign audiences to know that those are the situations when that phrase has been used is also significant. But if you step back a second, the Chinese strategy in this trade war has changed significantly in the last few weeks. President Trump announced an increase in the tariffs on May the 5th. Prior to that, China only responded to the tariffs that President Trump imposed, as in he imposed tariffs, they then imposed tariffs of their own. Now they're moving from a reactive strategy to a much more proactive strategy, and they're taking out the playbook that they have used many times in the past to intimidate and retaliate against other countries. And the playbook consists of, first, declaring that China is somehow the victim in the dispute, which I think is kind of interesting because China is running a $350 billion trade surplus in this situation. It's hardly a victim. Then trying to express outrage through the state media in order to whip up nationalism and defend Chinese dignity. And then the playbook includes making threats, which has already been done. After that, there's action. So I see this latest statement as a final declaration that now we are going to be taking action in the future, and we'll just have to wait to see what that is.
What could that be? What are they able to do? How far do you think they might go?
Well, the threat that they have made most obviously and most recently is to embargo rare earth metals that all countries that produce electronics need. China has 90-some% of the world's supply, and they have talked about embargoing it. They did that with Japan in 2010. Japan sued at the World Trade Organization. China lost the case, but there is a history of China doing that. Down the road, if you look at history, not only do you have responses like this, but China's playbook includes boycotts of iconic firms or boycotts on a much broader basis against American products in general. There can be popular protests. There have even been violence in the past. I'm not saying that's where we're going, but it's not hard to find many cases where China has played things out here. I think this is a huge mistake, because China's greatest interest is really preserving the status quo of that $350 billion trade surplus. And by doing this, they're going down a road that is going to alter things permanently, and it's going to be very hard to get back to where that status quo was to begin with.
Where would you put China's position as it stands now as far as trade is concerned?
Well, China, when it came into the WTO, promised to move from being a state-led economy to being a market-led economy. The WTO is an organization of market-led economies, where if I have some good that is best and at the best cost, I sell it to you and vice versa. There has to be a trade here. Instead, China is sticking to its state-led economy approach. And just last Saturday, there was an authoritative statement in Xinhua, the state press of China, basically saying that the industrial policies, the state-led industrial policies that are most of concern to the United States are now off-limits. They're not negotiable. They are, quote, core interests, which are buzzwords that China uses to cover interests like Taiwan. That they signal that those are the most important things to them. If that is the case, if China is really saying that it is going to remain a state-led economy, it is going to continue to subsidize its goods, sell them at below cost overseas, bankrupt foreign firms, and thereby capture markets, then we have a very serious problem in our trading system that's going to need to be rectified. And this trading dispute, if it's required to rectify that situation, then it's well worth getting into that kind of a dispute. I really think we need to get clarification on what China means, because if it really does mean that they can take actions like that as a matter of sovereign policy, then we have a major breakdown in our system. And China has basically renounced its obligations under WTO.
Well, how does that factor into the Trump tariffs? Have they worked? Are they working? Do you think it was the right thing to do?
Well, I think the Trump tariffs have at least got the attention of the Chinese. We had 30 years of year-round discussions under what was called the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade with China. And the reason that didn't produce results was that there was no teeth to the process. There were no negative consequences if either China wasn't forthcoming in the reforms that it said it wanted to undertake, or if it didn't perform under the obligations that it accepted. So tariffs are a mechanism to have some kind of accountability. Having said that, tariffs are not the best mechanism because they just inflict pain on both sides, and American consumers are paying the cost of all of this. So I wish there were another way, but at a minimum, we do have China's full attention on the trade concerns that are really at the heart of this dispute.
Huawei, one of the world's largest telecommunication equipment manufacturers, is a Chinese company that has basically been blacklisted by the Trump administration. They have gone to court in the United States. What are they doing here? Why are they going to court in the United States?
Well, I think this is mainly a chance for them to draw up attention, public attention to this situation. It doesn't seem to me very likely that they're going to win the case because they're asking for what's called summary judgment. Summary judgment is a motion that you make in a legal case when the law is very clear and there are absolutely no facts that are in dispute. Well, there are facts in dispute regarding the security situation with regard to Huawei. So I would be very surprised if they were able to achieve summary judgment. Ironically, though, what's also interesting to me is that Huawei is using rights, legal rights in the Western system here in the United States that no foreign company has in China. There's no ability of foreign companies to go sue in court against the Chinese government or to even appeal that when they have been banned from the China market. And there are many American companies that have been banned. So there are a lot of ironies in this situation. And as I said, I think it's mostly about publicity.
So you don't expect them to be successful, at least in that Texas courtroom. And if they are not, can they appeal?
I do not think they will be successful. Yes, under the American legal system, they probably could appeal. I don't think they'll succeed in that either. The way to resolve this is to get together, for the two governments to get together and start talking again about resolving the outstanding disputes in this trade war and matters involving Huawei as well.
Do you see an end to this trade war?
Yes. The United States and China have, for ever since relations resumed 30 years ago or so, have had many different disputes that have been very difficult to overcome. Think Tiananmen and other things. And we have always been able to resolve our disputes. So I think that we will be able to resolve this dispute. It's not looking like it's going to take longer rather than sooner. In order to get there, we have is a big complicating factor. We have a very unconventional president who doesn't operate according to the usual procedures that we use to get to an agreement. But ultimately, it's in the interest of both countries to reach an agreement. The economies are much more interdependent than both countries publicly are stating that they are. And I think that for the time being, both of the governments are overestimating their strength and underestimating their weakness. And it may take a little bit of time for that reality to sink in before we actually do get to an agreement.
Jeff, I thank you so much for being with us, and hopefully we can speak again soon.
Sure, my pleasure.
You just heard Jeff Moon tell us about the speculation that China might choose to retaliate for the latest tariffs by the United States of Chinese goods by banning the export of rare earth materials to the United States. We spoke about that with Tracy A. Moore, the president and CEO of the Canada Rare Earth Corporation in Vancouver, British Columbia.
The restriction of rare earths leaving China would enhance our business case greatly, but the business to get into business of the rare earths takes many, many years. So I don't think there would be an immediate positive effect other than the business case is better. In other words, to create a rare earth mine, for example, takes many years. To create the processing of the concentrate derived from the mines takes many years, special skills, a lot of money, and then a lot of extensive experience in operating the rare earth processing facilities.
Are there any mines either in construction or already underway in Canada or the United States?
In Canada, I'm not aware of any. There's some interesting prospects, but I would say no. And in the United States, I'm aware of one, and that's the Molycorp property, which was acquired by a consortium, including, to a small extent, a Chinese entity.
For those who are unaware, what are rare earths used for?
National Geographic, back in 2011, had an article entitled "The Secret Chinese Ingredients of Everything." And the article is quite general, but the title of the article is quite catchy and encompasses, you know, the general concept that rare earths are involved with everyday life to a very great extent. So telecommunications, electronics, electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles, even regular vehicles, polishing powders on lenses, cracking of oil, the tinting on windshields in cars, guidance systems on missiles, laptops, cell phones, the list goes on and on.
How is your business preparing for the possibility of China banning rare earths, at least to the United States?
Well, our business focus is to set up processing facilities of rare earth concentrate. So we have a number of initiatives on the go where we have developing alliances with rare earth mines and projects also that where rare earths are a byproduct or even a waste product of other mining ventures. But so the sourcing is one thing, but then the processing is another. And the processing, in our view, is the key to the supply chain. And that's actually where China dominates the market.
Well, you being in Canada, that would mean that possibly, at least in the beginning, that you would still be able to get the stuff to process from China, correct?
Well, rare earths are found everywhere. Not necessarily in mineable quantities, but there's a lot of rare earths found, particularly in the southern hemisphere. We're focusing primarily in South America, but also in Southeast Asia for sourcing, as well as Africa.
All right. As far as percentages are concerned, where would you put the geographic areas that you most use?
For sourcing material,
yeah.
South America is at this time probably 70 to 75%.
That much.
And then there's some Africa situations that are interesting, and also in Southeast Asia.
From where, other than China?
I'd rather not mention those countries for proprietary reasons. I think it's important to understand the supply chain. Companies in the commodity business tend to, you know, explore, hopefully create a mine, hopefully produce a concentrate, and then the concentrate needs to be processed. The processing in the rare earth industry is particularly difficult and unique. And then once the concentrate is processed, you create the oxides, which can be used for metals or alloys. So it's, in our view, it's the processing that's the key, obviously finding the material in the ground is important, but for many companies, unless they have a solution for finding, for processing the concentrate, they'll have to deal with China for the processing.
What about environmental effects of the processing? And the mining, too, for that matter. Yeah.
Right. It's always an issue, but there are ways of mitigating the situation. But typically, depending on the mineral that's hosting the rare earths, there can be a greater or lesser amount of radioactivity. And that's the one of the biggest issues, is how to properly handle and store or deal with the radioactivity, which is sort of a waste or byproduct from the processing, right? And so that's the biggest issue we encounter in establishing rare earth processing facilities. So for example, for the amount of rare earths that, say, would be in a ton of concentrate, it might be something like, say, 50% rare earths. There would be about 5% would be radioactivity, particularly thorium. 90% of the 5% would be thorium, and then the balance would be primarily uranium.
So miners have to be protected, do they not?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Are they in China? Do you know?
I know personally that China is taking environmental aspects more and more seriously. And I know of one refinery in particular that spent millions and millions of dollars and have had to go through all sorts of regulatory, you know, checks and balances to make sure that they can operate.
The legalization of marijuana for medical use in Thailand has created confusion over who can produce it and what qualifies consumers to legally use it. The National Assembly approved the legislation late last year, but the regulations governing the new law have yet to be put in place. Steve Sanford spoke to independent producers of cannabis oil, as well as consumers affected by the new law, as the government's deadline for users to register drew to a close this past week.
Across Thailand, thousands of users registered in accordance with the nation's new and still unclear medical marijuana law. Health officials who have taken brief courses about medical cannabis welcome those registering.
Right now, we are in a period of transition regarding government laws. They can use the documents to allow possession of marijuana for now until the government passes a final law. When that law is passed, patients using cannabis will have to consult with a doctor provided by the government.
Critics say big corporations will benefit from legalization because state-issued permits are needed to grow the plants. And Thai rights activists like Akradag Jakjinda are concerned that recreational use is still a criminal offense.
The biggest concern of the people is that the police will try to arrest them in their home because they have information. Right now, we've gotten assurance that if the authorities try to arrest us, the legal amnesty will protect us because we have already identified ourselves and told them how much we have.
For many who privately produce cannabis oil to treat family and friends for ailments like pain and depression, the benefits outweigh the risks. And while the ingredients and production are less than perfect, users claim that the home-produced remedies are working.
I'm trying to learn more because my father had cancer, and there is no other way. I don't want my dad to have to take chemical treatment or something like that. So I found a way to use cannabis oil, processed from marijuana, to treat him.
With the country still in the midst of finalizing the regulations governing medical marijuana, Thais will be watching to see who will truly benefit from this new law. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Krabi, Thailand.
South Korea's military says North Korea fired what appears to be two short-range ballistic missiles Thursday, the second time Pyongyang fired missiles in less than a week. One of the projectiles traveled 420 kilometers, the other 270 kilometers. The South Korean statement added the missiles were launched from North Pyongan province in the country's northwest and flew eastward. At the White House Thursday, President Trump said nobody is happy about the development, adding that he doesn't believe North Korea is ready to negotiate. South Korea's presidential Blue House said it's very worried about the apparent short-range missile launch, adding it does not help inter-Korean military tensions. South Korean officials say Seoul has increased security preparations in case of additional launches. Joining us on VOA Asia is Dr. Stephen Norper, the senior director of the Korea Society and a professor at Columbia University. Dr. Norper, in your opinion, what's driving this change of direction as far as North Korea is concerned?
Well, what North Korea is trying to do in the wake of the failed Hanoi summit is up the ante and try to increase leverage, in particular with the Americans. So the short-range missile tests are worrisome, but at the same time, they're not intermediate or long-range missile tests. So they're just within the realm of what they consider acceptability and not a violation, in their opinion, of the moratorium. That said, because they're ballistic, they, as South Korea has pointed out, may be violations of UN sanctions.
Now, they have come through yesterday, 24 hours ago or so, saying this is nothing but a military drill. But obviously, this is a statement of where they stand, as you have just explained. What can the United States really do as far as reaction to this other than what's been said already?
Well, the U.S. has concerns and certainly is at full readiness along with South Korea as they weigh options in terms of how to respond. That said, it's important not to overplay the aspect because the negotiation table is where the North Koreans want to be. They're not trying to negate negotiations with the missile test. They're simply trying to shake the bars, as it were. And so we'll have to see what happens next in terms of Washington's response. Secretary of State Pompeo is on the way back, and it looks like they'll be discussing this issue, certainly with the South Koreans as well. And it's concerning, but not overly so relative to the fact that it's not a long-range missile test or a break in the nuclear moratorium.
It has been said by some that Kim Jong-un is playing Donald Trump. Do you agree?
Well, he's playing Donald Trump, but he's also trying to take the time to sort out their own next steps. And he being Kim Jong-un, was clearly caught by surprise by Trump's walk away from Hanoi. And so, again, this is designed to sort of get attention, to rattle the bars without going too far. That said, the Americans now have also announced that they have a North Korean cargo ship that they're returning off the U.S. coast. This was seized last year, and so it's not a new story per se, but the announcement of it is designed to say to North Korea, sanctions enforcement is in effect.
What's next? Do you consider this brinksmanship on either side or both sides, and what do you think is going to happen here?
Well, it is on both sides, and it's a reminder to the international community that tensions can flare, and we don't want to be back where we were in 2017 with the discussion about a military strike and very high tensions on both sides. So we need to be cautious here not to overreact and to read it as a security concern and a potential violation, but at the same time, an effort to get to the negotiating table. And so that really behooves us to say, you know, it's serious. The security threat is serious. Let's see what we can do to get a third round between the North Korean and U.S. leaders going and to try to allow room for South Korea's peace offensive to take hold. And that includes demilitarization and confidence-building measures.
And is that a possibility?
That's certainly what the South Koreans are thinking, and President Moon Jae-in has banked his presidency on a warming with the North Koreans, just as they've now struck a military thumb at the United States and South Korea, so too they've been ignoring South Korea's diplomatic overtures. But this whole process started to work around the Pyeongchang Olympics and around South Koreans' efforts to get North Korea to the table. So for this to continue, North Korea is going to have to back down and reapproach the negotiating table with Trump, and all roads lead through Seoul, meaning Moon Jae-in's calm, steady rudder on this process.
Is this whole situation back to square one?
I don't think so. I think if it had been a long-range missile test, clearly it would be much more alarming. But we're talking short-range missile tests. In 2017, this might not even have rated a story, but it's because we have been in a pause. But we've gone from Hanoi to hiatus, and it's time now to address the security concern and to get North Korea to the table to take steps toward denuclearization.
Japan's leader has already said he would like to meet with Kim Jong-un. Where does Japan stand? Where does China stand? And where does Russia stand on all of this, or anybody else for that matter?
Well, Japanese Prime Minister Abe had announced that intention, but it was only 2 days later that the North Koreans tested a volley of short-range missiles last week. And so that probably puts Japan's role and the likelihood of a meeting in some question. They also opposed food aid to North Korea. So we'll see where that goes. But in terms of China and Russia, clearly they have had overtures with Kim Jong-un. Vladimir Putin just met with Kim Jong-un in the Russian Far East, and North Korea considers that it has leverage with both of those large powers, both former sponsors, and that's helped bully their resolve in this. That said, we should be thinking about approaching China and Russia, despite difficulties in U.S. relations with both, to help us strike at a solution and to augur to the North Koreans that denuclearization really is the priority here.
Well, does this mean the possibility of a resumption of six-party talks?
Well, that's what the Russians have expressed an interest in. U.S. National Security Advisor Bolton has said that's not the best mechanism, but there will be some sort of multilateralism and dialogue that ensues, whether it's all those parties together or whether it's a series of mini-laterals or mini-multilaterals. Clearly, the United States, China, and Russia will be involved, and the United States has important alliance relations with both Japan and South Korea, which, again, has guided this process. So it'll take a lot of international coordination alongside any bilateral U.S.-North Korea negotiation.
What is the possibility of North Korea ever giving up its nuclear program?
Well, the consensus of the U.S. intelligence community and the military intelligence community beyond that is that it's unlikely that they would give up the entirety of their nuclear capability. That said, that's no reason not to push for denuclearization, and whether this rather long process of denuclearization begins with partial denuclearization, with declarations and verifications of some facilities, progress in arms control discussions, it's a start. And clearly the moratorium is a start, and one that the White House has announced has been to this point a success. So that continued moratorium and a step beyond towards denuclearization is really all important, given the lethality of North Korea's missile and nuclear capabilities.
What's the possibility of a reduction in sanctions in the near future?
Well, that would take some show of North Korean good faith, and clearly a resumption of a third summit with the Americans and coming to the table with a level of at least some acceptable efforts at denuclearization, some promise of verification. But that said, I think the United States would probably be prepared to enter into some partial lifting of sanctions, in particular on the front where it involved inter-Korean economic cooperation. So if South Korea was to make the request to the Security Council, that would probably be what was needed. And all of those sanctions resolutions have language built in for the partial relief of those over time, and again, in the presence of good faith. And we're not seeing that with this current round of tests. But if we can get there, that's the aspiration.
Anything else you care to add here that say into this conversation?
I think the only thing I'd add is that clearly the U.S. Trade negotiations with China and the downtick in that is something the North Koreans are watching. They're also watching the situation with Iran. And so while those are heavy foreign policy distractors for the United States, along with Venezuela and other issues, the North Koreans are trying to gauge U.S. Insistence and follow through by what's happening with China on the economic front and with Iran on the nuclear front. So we will we'll have to see what influences those are. But if China and the United States ratchet up the trade war, if there's a lack of cooperation, that actually hurts the inter-Korean process and stability on the peninsula, because it means the two would be at odds as opposed to trying to strike a common understanding for how to get North Korea to the negotiating table. And in that sense, the large powers play an important role.
As the U.S. and China escalate their trade standoff, consumers in both countries are starting to see the impact. VOA's Mikhailo Komitovsky reports from Washington.
Bill Locke has been selling bikes for more than 4 years, and this is the second time his shop has dealt with tariff increases.
The manufacturers tried to eat as much as they could, and then companies like us, you know, tried to eat as much, so the price increase was very small. You know, 5-7% increases.
Locke says customers should buy new bikes as soon as possible because the prices are going to go up.
A lot of the people, it's going to price them out of the market. They're going to, you know, be used to looking at maybe an entry-level $500 bike that's now going to go to $600. They're going to see a bike that they might have wanted to ride recreationally at $1,000 or $1,500, and that's suddenly going to go to, you know, $1,500 to $2,000, $2,500. They're going to see big price changes coming up over the next, you know, couple months here.
Many buyers themselves say they are not ready to shell out extra cash.
That's not something I want to actually do. I don't want to pay more for a product that costs less before.
I probably wouldn't be willing to pay that much extra if it's due to different tariffs or things like that that are being implemented with the economic tension. Maybe $50-$100 more, but it would probably limit if I wanted to get another bike.
Imposing the new tariff will impact the entire market, Locke explains. The majority of U.S. assembled bikes are not 100% American-made. Either the bike frames, forks, or brakes are manufactured in China, but first, prices for fully Chinese ones will rise up.
So you're looking at a bike that's $500, is going to go up $100.
New prices, Bill says, will possibly scare the customers, leading to greater losses. Then the used bicycle market will come into play.
The problem is a lot of the used bikes in the DC market are stolen. So what it's going to do is it's going to increase the amount of people who are stealing bikes because they can resell them more easily because the price of new bikes has gone up. And the price of the used bikes, they can get whatever they can pay for.
Another demonstration of how changes in one part of the economy can lead to unintended consequences elsewhere as the trade war drags on. Mikhailo Komitovsky, VOA News, Washington.
Tariffs that have made up a large part of the continuing trade war between the U.S. and China are having a worldwide effect. The apparel or clothing industry is just one example. In the month of May 2019, the clothing industry in Bangladesh saw the orders from buyers in the United States jump over 15.5%. That meant an increase of $1.63 billion. That's billions with a B. Marcia Dixon is a professor and department chairman in fashion and apparel studies at the University of Delaware. Dr. Dixon is internationally known for her research and teaching on socially responsible practices in the apparel industry. I asked her how tariffs against Chinese products were affecting countries like Bangladesh.
I think you could probably attribute that jump at this point in time to the pending tariffs and the threats of tariffs. You know, this industry has a long history of producing clothing globally, no matter what the tariff situation is, no matter what the duty situation is. If you think back decades, we had the multi-fiber agreement, and this caused really production to be spread all over the world to many, you know, over 150 developing countries. And it was primarily because the U.S. had bilateral agreements that prevented the amount of clothing that could be imported from China. And so, you know, this just meant that production popped up all over the world, including in places like Bangladesh. So we can attribute, you know, to Bangladesh's early start in production to protectionist trade policies that the U.S. had. Now, it's also interesting to think about over time how these protectionist trade policies didn't really work. So because, you know, it just meant that instead of having production come back to the U.S., you just had production shift to other countries like Bangladesh. So, you know, when you have sourcing professionals and leaders of companies who are thinking about where is their product coming, and that has to be, you know, thought about well in advance of when it ships, they are always taking into consideration the political situation relevant to trade from any particular country. And that can be, you know, the general system preferences. It can be tariffs like this, or it can be any sort of disruption. But they're always constantly thinking about, you know, is it safe to go ahead and put orders in China or elsewhere, given the current political climate? So this has been, you know, certainly a topic of discussion and consideration for the supply chain officers of big retailers and brands for, you know, since the tariffs came up.
How big of a business is apparel in places? And again, we'll take Bangladesh, but also other countries that are affected, we understand, are Vietnam, Cambodia, Turkey, a few others, I guess, right?
Yeah. Well, in countries like Bangladesh, Cambodia, you know, apparel exports accounts for vast amounts of their GDP. I think I heard 70-80% in Bangladesh. So it's a huge, huge business. So, you know, they want the business, of course. They want to be producing clothing for the U.S. We've been with my Better Buying initiative. You know, I'm out there talking with suppliers all the time. Globally. And we've been hearing for well over 4 years, well before the, you know, the Trump administration and the threats of tariffs to China, we've been hearing from suppliers about the need to move production out of China. And it wasn't simply because, you know, the threat of, you know, trade wars, but it was the costs of production. So, you know, there's been a worker shortage and the costs of the wages are rising for Chinese workers. And so the Chinese have already been moving production out of China actively since, you know, for at least 4 years. And on the directives of some of their retailer brand customers who are saying basically, if you don't have factories outside of China, you're not going to get orders from us. And this is in an effort to reduce the cost of production. And so what you see is the Chinese are, you know, the owners of many of the production facilities in Cambodia. In some cases, in Bangladesh. Now, Bangladesh still has a lot of local ownership as well. But, you know, the Chinese have been moving production out of China for quite some time.
The answer to the question is wherever you get the cheapest labor cost, right?
Well, that's right. And Better Buying was recently talking with some suppliers about that situation because, you know, now they're being pushed to move to countries like Ethiopia, where the production is really just getting started. And they're quite concerned about that because it's too soon to push things there, yet they're being asked to move sometimes all their production to a new facility in Ethiopia. And so what we're going to see there is, you know, lower quality clothing because it may reduce costs in the short term, but it's the skills aren't there yet to produce the kind of quality clothing that we've come to expect in the U.S. And so the manufacturers who are, you know, heading up the production facilities are this, give us time. We will move some of the production there, but we need time to train the workforce so that they can produce what you need and to produce it efficiently. So even that, you know, while it's an effort to lower costs, will not lower them as much as we think because there'll be more work that has to be redone for quality mistakes and errors, and there'll just be a less efficient production.
I remember many years ago, made in China here in the United States meant cheap but basically subpar products. That's basically what you're talking about now for the smaller countries, correct?
Right. That's right. China now can do, they're very good at making clothing. They can do anything we ask. And that's why they're still such an important country to the industry, because, you know, many of the lower cost countries can do basic commodity production. And that's really been the specialty even of Bangladesh, but they can't take on the higher value add products that we also love. You know, we all don't really just want to wear basic t-shirts. So, you know, China's very good at what they do.
You brought up Ethiopia, but what about more established nations? And again, Bangladesh comes up along with Vietnam and some others. Is the quality of their apparel as good as was coming from China, as is coming from China?
So, you know, I think the funny thing is, when you think about Vietnam and many parts of the world, that the clothing that's produced there is often produced for a parent company that's based in China, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, or in South Korea. You know, I don't think we have the precise data on how much of the world's clothing production is comes from companies based in that the China region, China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and South Korea, but it's a whole lot. And so, you know, almost all the, if not all of the Cambodian manufacturers are owned by companies or by companies outside of Cambodia. China is in a big way. And the same with Vietnam. There is Vietnamese ownership as well, but there's an awful lot of Chinese-owned manufacturing there. So, you know, that's that talent of China is being passed on to countries like Vietnam. Interestingly, I think Bangladesh has had a little less foreign investment, but, you know, there are Korean-owned, there are Chinese-owned facilities there, and they're certainly benefiting from that. I think even right this moment, there's a delegation of Hong Kong-based manufacturers in Bangladesh looking at investing in their apparel industry. So it's there is that transfer of knowledge and skill taking place from China to the other parts of the world, but it's just not there yet. Bangladesh is still known for lower cost commodity production. But, you know, that's changing. It's just not changing quite fast enough to deal with the tariff situation.
What is this going to do to the safety of garment workers in a place like Bangladesh if they have to greatly expand what they are doing? We remember all kinds of horrific stories coming from Dhaka and the rest of Bangladesh, basically Dhaka, about what has happened to apparel workers.
Right. And that's a real concern. I think, you know, since the Rana Plaza building collapse that killed over 1,100 people, you know, the country has really taken on a huge effort with the support of the branded retailers that purchase from Bangladesh to improve workplace conditions. And you have some beautiful factories in Bangladesh and definitely improvements. There's always more to improve. I'll be clear about that. But there has been great strides in worker safety in Bangladesh. Now, at the same time, you know, our better buying data shows that the volume of shipments coming from Bangladesh to the various brands and retailers around the world are relatively stable compared to many places in the world, and compared to Turkey, for example, that's known as a really fast fashion, quick turn country. And so Bangladesh has benefited from all that attention of the world and the brands and retailers around the world on their workplace conditions. And they benefited from, you know, being incentivized for more responsible production and also being awarded, more consistent volume of commodity orders. So now if you start thinking about trying to push more production there, you're going to see more of the peaks and valleys across time that really start to get factories and subsequently their workers into risk of noncompliance to codes of conduct related to overtime, related to unauthorized subcontracting, and various things like that, use of temporary labor. So I am worried that as we push too much on Bangladesh, they're going to start feeling what many other parts of the world have in terms of this up and down of production that is really hard to plan for and really hard to accommodate. I'm not saying they can't. You know, the industry is starting off on a strategic path to be, you know, much more than a low-cost commodity producer of clothing. But, you know, that's, they're at the beginning of that process, and this, you know, could create some challenges for them.
Overall, how much are these tariffs going to hurt China, and how much are they going to help a place like Bangladesh?
Well, you know, the protectionist trade measures of the past show us that a lot of countries can be helped. It never stopped production in China, and I don't think it will stop production in China now either. And ironically, because China still owns much of the global production around the world in different locations, it's still going to help China. China's still going to win, even though it may not be for factories producing within China. The companies that own factories around the world, many are Chinese, and they will continue to thrive. Now, nobody's thriving in this industry, however. Nobody's thriving. The retailers and brands, you know, it's every day is more news about store closures and the pressures on them, and the pressures are being pushed down the supply chain. So the interesting thing is, I think prices will have to rise, and I think it's good in a sense, because this is an industry that's needed to raise its prices for a long time. You know, we've been under deflationary pricing of clothing despite increases in worker wages, increases in raw materials, increases in energy prices, et cetera. So this is an industry where a responsible brand or retailer really needs to think about how to raise the prices and how to pay higher prices to their suppliers. I think this is an opportunity to do that. Don't just raise your prices to cover the tariffs. Raise your prices to cover what the true cost of producing clothing in socially responsible and environmentally sustainable ways requires, and ways that will allow the industry to sustain in the future, because many of these suppliers, Chinese and otherwise, would like to invest in automation, would like to invest in plant improvements that can provide more efficient production in more reliable ways without taking a toll on workers. And they just can't do it with the margins that they've had. So if we try to keep the prices down or just raise them to cover the tariffs that are put in place, we're not going to get ahead as an industry. This is an opportunity to say, hey, world, hey, consumers, we have to start charging you for what it really costs to make clothing.
What about if you can expand just a little bit on how much and how this will help a country like Bangladesh?
Yeah, so I think definitely Bangladesh is probably set to get more orders because of this, of the tariffs, as more production is earmarked to be produced elsewhere. Bangladesh is well set to do that. You know, they're already producing a lot of clothing. They have a lot of very good manufacturers there. They have a lot of depth in their workforce. So I do believe that they will have some increases, and then they'll have challenges that are associated with accommodating that increase production. I don't want to discount our Bangladesh suppliers in any way. They're very good suppliers, but if we get a tremendous push, you know, the capacity around the world cannot accommodate what's been produced in China in any sort of orderly way.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend, a special edition where you're hearing the full-length versions of many of the interviews and features that we presented through the past few months in our daily VOA Asia program. The United States recently announced it will no longer exempt a small set of countries, including China, from its oil sanctions regime against Iran. I spoke with Richard Nephew, a senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University in New York, about what that might do to the relationships between the U.S. and those countries.
Well, I think it's certainly the case that the imposition of tighter oil sanctions against Iran is going to have an impact on Chinese trade interests, right? You know, the Chinese have a very present need for energy and cheap energy. Iran has been a supplier of that. And of course, Iran is also a important country in the Belt and Road Initiative that China is advancing as well. So from a Chinese perspective, Iran is fairly important. And U.S. efforts to try and constrain Chinese ability to do business with Iran is, of course, important as well.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, visited Tokyo Thursday, received a warm welcome from Japan's leader Shinzo Abe, and that followed a trip to India. And a meeting is now scheduled for Friday in Beijing. What do you think Zarif is looking for, and can he get it?
Well, I think Zarif is essentially doing damage control. He's attempting to persuade countries around the world that Iran is the sober and serious actor here, that it's the United States that is causing both instability and threats to international energy supply. And so I think what he's trying to say is, listen, we didn't start this. We didn't start this crisis. We don't want to have a crisis. We're following the rules that are laid out in the nuclear agreement back in 2015. The United States isn't. And so we need you, China. We need you, Japan. We need you, India, to help us, because first of all, it's the right thing to do, especially China. You're part of the nuclear agreement. But then also because there is economic interest in doing so. And lastly, because there is an interest in pushing back on the U.S. and the U.S.'s ability to dictate foreign policy decisions to these countries.
Do you think he might be successful in any way, shape or form, Zarif?
Well, I think he'll be successful in getting international sympathy. He'll be successful in getting international support. He won't necessarily be successful in getting international economic access. So at the end of the day, what I think he will get is a warm reception, handshakes, agreement that the United States is acting recklessly. But at the end of the day, Chinese, Japanese, Indian, and other countries have to make their own decisions, and they have to make them in the full consideration of their economic interests. And in many ways, that comes with not daring the United States to impose sanctions on their oil companies and banks.
Both China and Japan have ceased buying oil from Iran, as I understand it. Is there any possibility that in light of the U.S.-China trade stalemate that they might change their mind?
Yeah, I think it's still unclear what the Chinese have agreed to do and what they have decided to do. You know, we've seen in recent months the Chinese actually increase significantly their purchases of Iranian oil. We've seen a lag in the delivery of Iranian oil, which makes us think that maybe they bought a lot and now they're not buying a whole lot. But frankly, the data is inconclusive at this point. It's going to take us another couple of weeks to really know what the Chinese have done. Of course, politically, they said they will never follow U.S. sanctions and fulfill U.S. Requirements in U.S. law. I think in terms of the trade deal and trade context, the Chinese certainly have an interest and an incentive to try and build leverage. And Iran policy may be one way in which they do it. On the other hand, I think the Chinese are worried that that actually cuts against them, and that by creating more areas of friction, it'll be easier for people like John Bolton and others to press the president to be much tougher and much harder. And so from that perspective, I think there's a desire in China to keep these streams separate, especially because they could be so complicated.
And what about Japan? Why such a warm greeting from Abe?
Well, I think the Japanese made a calculation a couple of years ago when Trump was first elected that their national interest at the heart is a strong alliance with the United States, with the region that they live in, with North Korea and with China as potential threats, with the dependence they have on the U.S. military, with the dependence they have on U.S. economic relations, they need the United States. And so I think Abe's approach from the start has been keep Trump close, you know, bear hug him and make sure that he can't withdraw troops from Japan, that he can't downgrade the relationship. And I think that's still kind of their motivating focus. The one thing I will say is this is, of course, a dynamic circumstance and a dynamic situation. You know, as oil prices fluctuate, especially if oil prices go up, with the problem the Russians have had exporting oil, with what's going on in Libya, with the threat to Persian Gulf oil coming in and out, I think you're going to have a lot of countries have to make decisions that they aren't really happy with. But if oil starts hitting $100 a barrel or something you know, that large, they're going to have a real economic reason to consider doing business with Iran, even if the United States doesn't like it. And I think that's going to add a lot of complexity to U.S. decision making.
And what does this do to relationships between Japan, India, China, and the United States? And, of course, China and the United States are only already on the way down. So.
That's right. I think it creates both direct tensions and issues between the United States and those countries and amongst them. I mean, you can easily see if the Chinese decide to flout U.S. sanctions and Japan has not, that this would be an issue in U.S.-Japanese relations, certainly an issue in Chinese-Japanese relations. You can make similar arguments about India and its economic situation, especially in the context of elections. So I think it has the prospect of raising tensions and causing problems if the U.S. continues to insist on a hard line and isn't consistent with how it approaches all three of those countries.
Richard Nephew is adjunct professor and senior research scholar at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University in New York City. And the traffic noise continues in New York City. Thank you, Richard.
All right, thank you.
A Belgian abbey is working to revive its centuries-old tradition of beer making after a break of 220 years. The monks at the Grimbergen Abbey are looking into ancient recipes to offer specialty beers in their new microbrewery. Meanwhile, researchers in Israel have made beer with yeast extracted from thousands of year-old jars found in archaeological digs. Beer is one of the oldest and most popular beverages in the world, and producers are vying for customers with new and attractive brews. But as VOA's Lada Chahok reports, there is a growing interest in traditional beers and the history of brewing.
Beer connoisseurs' perpetual quest for new and interesting brews has sparked a global trend of microbreweries offering their own specialty beers. Monks at Grimbergen Abbey in Belgium have looked into their own beer-making past and decided to revive the order's brewing heritage.
Brewing and religion life was all we come together. And when we have now the opportunity to also give, and with the support of Alkemaas and the support of Carlsberg, you don't must wait from that. And so that was the start of a dream to bring back the Grimbergen in a little part here in the microbrewery.
The monks are combining old recipes detailed in books, some dating back to the 12th century, with modern techniques to craft limited edition batches.
So what will be special about the beer? We will keep our Grimbergen DNA, which is a yeast, and we will also use some local ingredients. For example, we are start to grow hops in the garden of the abbey. So we are thinking about limited batch that will bring some hops from the garden, and also working with local farmers and local actors here in Grimbergen.
The Grimbergen microbrewery will open to the public in late 2020 and is projected to produce about 10,000 hectoliters of beer at the abbey. Larger quantities will be produced in other countries. The interest in ancient brewing methods doesn't stop there. Israeli researchers say they have extracted yeast from the remains of jars found at archaeological sites and have used them to concoct a brew similar to the kind imbibed by pharaohs thousands of years ago.
We know that they used wheat, they used yeast, they used water, and they didn't have any preservators like today. For the beer. Now, what they added, there were some flavoring material, like date concentration and things like this, maybe honey.
On Wednesday, researchers from Jerusalem's Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University presented a beer brewed with yeast descended from a 3,000-year-old jar. They plan to combine ancient recipes with modern methods to brew beer that could one day be produced commercially. Zlatica Ho, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for being with us for this special edition of VOA Asia Weekend. In Washington, I'm Ira Melman. This is your invitation to join us next week and to stay in touch with us at all times at voanews.com, along with our numerous social media platforms.